From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, welcome to Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Our guest today, Mr. Clay Jenkinson, is a time traveler of sorts. He's made a serious exploration into the life, times, and writings of Thomas Jefferson and brought it to life as a Jefferson reenactor. Jenkinson is an award-winning author, humanities scholar, and host of the syndicated radio program, The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Clay Jenkinson inhabited the role of President Thomas Jefferson at Town Hall Seattle this past November 22, 2014. He was joined by the St. Michael Trio for a performance of chamber music popular during Jefferson's time, including works by Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven, who were Jefferson's contemporaries. In this podcast version of this appearance by President Thomas Jefferson, you'll hear the following pieces from the St. Michael Trio: Haydn's Piano Trio in E Major, Mozart's Trio in G Major, Beethoven's Opus No. 1, and Haydn's Trio in C Major. This event was presented by the Seattle Public Library as part of its 2014 McClellan O'Donnell Living History Series. Thanks to Town Hall Seattle for this recording.
My dear citizens, thank you so much for inviting me to come this far into the American West. As I'm sure you know, in 1803, I had the opportunity to double the size of our republic with a single stroke of my pen. The Louisiana Purchase added 828,000 square miles to the United States, or 575 million acres, and the purchase price was $15.6 million, or 3 cents per acre. It was the greatest land sale in the history of the world, and it effectively was the making moment of our national destiny, because now we had essentially infinite space in the West on which to expand, and it meant that there would be no hostile neighbors on the West, Spain or France or Russia or Britain, to harry us, that this was going to be a two-ocean continental empire for liberty, such as the world had never previously seen. But I think you also know that in the course of my life, I never traveled more than 75 miles west of my birthplace. And so it is a great pleasure to come all this way to the other end of the continent. I went to Europe in the summer of 1784 to serve as an American minister plenipotentiary to the court of Louis XVI. I went there in some part because my private life had fallen apart at Monticello. I was married just once for 10 years, and my wife was an extraordinary woman, a fine musician, but she was worn down by pregnancies and birthings, and she died at the age of 33 on September 6, 1782. This clouded all of my prospects and hopes for life, and I had essentially what you would call a nervous breakdown. For days, I lay on a pallet in my sleeping chamber. I refused to sleep in the bed. Meals were handed in to me through a secret door. When I finally went out, I rode my horse at breakneck speed through the Blue Ridge Mountains, and my young daughter Martha would follow behind me on her mare a quarter of a mile or half a mile behind to see that I would return safely. And she was so worried about me for a time that she actually had all of the firearms at Monticello locked up. This was a very desperate time for me. My closest friend, James Madison, the fourth president, the father of the Constitution and the author of the Bill of Rights, Madison realized that I probably would be unable to recover my spirits if I stayed within the environs of Monticello, and so Madison encouraged the Congress of the United States to send me to France to serve as a diplomat there, to further American financial and mercantile interests in France. So I spent 5 years there. Shortly after I arrived, Dr. Franklin was finally allowed to retire. He was elderly and his health was indifferent, and he had been seeking retirement for a very long time. And so I was then named the second American ambassador to France. That period in my life was an extraordinarily rich one. I said of the French that the only thing that I envied them was their music, that they were the most extraordinary musicians that I had ever heard. But during that time, I fell in love with their sculpture, their painting, their conversation, their salons. I said later in my life, every man's first country must be his own, but every rational man's second country is France. I said one can pass his entire life in France and never hear a single rude remark. It helps to know French, of course. But this was a period in which not only did I see what human artistic achievement can be at its best, but I also had the unique opportunity to witness a second revolution in my lifetime. I had been a part, as you know, of the American Revolution, and now suddenly I was witnessing the beginnings of what became a much greater cataclysm, the French Revolution. I always knew that the little flame that we lit on the 4th of July, 1776, would cross the Atlantic and begin to engulf the tyrannies and the despotisms and the superstitions and the failed ideas of the old world. But witnessing it, being able to see this second greater revolution in place, was one of the great satisfactions of my life. And I remember, for example, going to Lafayette's home. He had been this ardent young Frenchman who had helped us to win our independence. And now he was one of the reformists, the aristocratic reformists in France. I went many times to his home, and in his hallway there were two frames, and one of them had a frame of my Declaration of Independence. And then the second frame, identical in size, was blank. It was just a blank in the center of it. And when people would ask him what this could possibly mean, he said it was waiting for a French Declaration of Rights equal to the nobility of what the Americans had done. So that gave me a tremendous sense of American satisfaction. Now, I know that the French Revolution eventually grew to great excess, and Robespierre and others brought about a reign of terror, but I defended the French Revolution, including the terror. You know, when people have been held down for centuries, you know, systematically ground down by bad government and imperfect institutions, when they finally awaken and reclaim their primordial rights, they seldom do it politely. Bloodletting is a necessary catharsis after hundreds of years of systematic oppression. Lafayette wrote me a gloomy letter about the terror, and I wrote back a rebuke and said, "Sir, did you expect to be transported from despotism to liberty on a feather bed? Blood is the stuff of liberty. When my favorite protege, William Short, who lingered on in France after I returned, wrote to me complaining about the excesses of the terror, I wrote back an even sharper letter and said, rather than that this revolution should have failed, I would have seen half the earth desolated if there were one Adam and one Eve alive in every nation and alive free. That would be greater than all of the despotisms of history. And that period in France deepened my own philosophical radicalism, because I saw what can happen to a nation that goes desperately wrong. You know, Voltaire said, in France, every man is either the hammer or the anvil. And so I wrote a series of letters during this period back to my closest friend Madison, examining the foundations of civilization, you know, the shift from a state of nature to a state of culture, what sort of taxation is just, how we distribute property and land over generations, what one generation's duty is to its predecessors and its successors. This series of letters are amongst the most important that I ever wrote, and they were touched off by these earth-shattering social events in France. Then I came back in November of 1789. I wanted to bring my two daughters back to Virginia. I was afraid that they were becoming Europeanized. I wanted them to restore them to the more congenial ground in Virginia. But I intended to spend a couple of months at Monticello taking care of some pressing business, advancing my building plans. I wanted completely to redesign Monticello after seeing buildings in France. But when I arrived at Norfolk, there was a letter waiting for me from George Washington, my old friend. He was now the President of the United States, and he announced to me that he had decided to nominate me to be the first Secretary of State, and that the Senate had already approved the appointment. He did this without asking me. I felt that I could not honestly decline an offer from George Washington, but I, in fact, had wanted to go back to France to see the revolution through. It was an extraordinary moment in the history of the world, and I will defend it in spite of the blood that ran in the streets of Paris. And it changed the nature of my political outlook when I returned to this country. I had become radicalized by seeing what can really happen in a nation. While most other Americans had drifted to the right in a kind of counter-revolution, and they were wanting a more high-toned, centralized government with a national bank and a national debt and a large peacetime army and navy and strong, centralized, and consolidated government. And so this led to the great tension of the 1790s, which finally, in 1800, brought about the Second American Revolution and made me, somewhat against my better judgment, the third president of the United States. I'll have more to say, but I think now, sir, I yield to you.
Thank you, Mr. President. We're going to play the music of Mozart. And we want to offer Mozart because it establishes the setting for the events that you've just referenced. So this is Mozart, as he would have been heard in the salons, and indeed the courts of the aristocracy and the nobility, and particularly in France. When he was a lad of just 4 years old, he toured the European capitals and in the court of Louis XVI, in his ineffable way, he hopped up onto the lap of Marie Antoinette, and he patted her on the cheeks, and he kissed her on the lips. And he said, I love you. And the music that we'll now play has that ineffable character to it. It also has this crystalline flavor to it. And it's painting a picture of Europe in its mannered and genteel form. And we're doing this because we want to set up a contrast that will come later. Thank you.
Thank you.
that's extraordinarily beautiful. Possibly a little jaunty for my tastes. When I think of music, I think of harmony. And it sort of ties into my deism. You know, deism is the idea that the universe is so orderly and beautiful, with the solar system and its centrifugal and centripetal force, and the universal law of gravitation, which governs the moons of Jupiter and the coins in your pocket. And the idea that the Earth is in the one place in the solar system that can support life, and no other. This is clearly design. This is not the yeasty stuff of the cosmos. This is design. And where there is design, there must be a designing agent or a creator. And so the deist God, if you want to call this being that, I prefer creator, is in my view a kind of celestial Newtonian mechanic who has built the universe and spun the planets, but now stands serenely back and watches his handiwork unfold, you know, possibly from time to time coming in to fine-tune the clock a bit, but not answering your prayers or mine. There's no prayer that we can give to so perfect a workman, except thy will be done. And so if it's true that the universe has this deep underlying design, and that the creator is a kind of celestial mechanic, then music at its best reveals those harmonies. And it's sometimes said of Bach that you can hear the music of the spheres behind his music, that you can actually hear the gears of the solar system in their beautiful harmonious unfolding behind the music that he created. And so for me, music was not entertainment, although it entertains. It was some resonance that we have with natural laws that run much deeper than most human perception. And architecture, take the University of Virginia, for example, which I created in my retirement. When I wanted to build a library there, I decided to use the Pantheon of Rome as its model, because the Pantheon, which dates to the second century, is essentially a perfect solid. If you took my rotunda, which is a miniature version of it, or the Pantheon itself, and made a slice of it, it's a sphere enclosed in a cylinder. And so when you stand back and look at it, you're not merely impressed, it's resonating with something deep in your soul that searches for symmetry and beauty and order and cosmos. The Greek word cosmos means the beautiful order of things. And so when I went to France, here was this extraordinarily fertile country with 20 million people, people of great civility and politeness who had taken the arts to their acme. No nation had ever produced arts to match those of the French, and particularly their music. And yet you hear this marvelous music, while in the streets there are bread riots and people who literally are starving to death, who can't feed their children, who are begging or being reduced to thievery. The contrast between what France could do as a civilization and how badly it was being governed, and how, unfortunately, the distribution of the fruits of life occurred there, created a kind of paradox. At the same time I was falling in love with European culture, I was deploring the societies that could produce it. And so the question that I wrestled with all of my life was, could we bring a higher artistic achievement to the United States without creating the cities and the class systems and the social subordination and social hierarchies that were destroying Europe? Or would we be better off with a kind of folk culture which comes from the people and maybe doesn't reach this level of artistry, but doesn't necessitate urban densities and the inequalities that had bedeviled France and other European nations. I never really solved this problem to my satisfaction. I just want to tell you two quick stories about my time in France before we hear another piece of this exquisite music. One of them involves peasant agriculture. You know, John Adams was in London at the same time that I was in Paris, and we met at The Hague to handle some difficulties of the American financial system. And as I was traveling in a carriage through the countryside of northern France, I saw a farmer plowing with a very inefficient plow. And this caused a kind of chain of reflection, because the plow is just about the oldest tool that we have. And thousands of years ago, somebody began to scratch the earth somehow, and the plow is really just a set of variations and refinements on this very primitive engineering. I said the plow is the magic wand of civilization, because once we stopped gathering food and began to be able to plant it, putting clusters of wheat together, or small patches of flax or rye or corn, once we began to concentrate using till agriculture, this was the basis from which civilization sprang forth in the Tigris and Euphrates valleys. So it troubled me to see, as late as 1786, a plow that was that inefficient. I happened to know calculus. You know, calculus had been simultaneously invented by Leibniz and Newton, and it was a new mathematical science, and I was one of the first Americans to know it. We called it fluxions then. So I actually got out of the carriage and took out of my bag a notebook, and I sat down in the furrow with this farmer, whom I suppose was somewhat surprised, and using calculus, I worked out what I called the moldboard of least resistance. If you think about it, a plow lifts the earth and turns it, and any plow has an enormous amount of resistance. But if you can minimize the resistance, you have created a perfect plowshare. And using fluxions or calculus, I was able to do it. And when I got back to this country, I had that plow made in a wooden prototype. You can see it in the Smithsonian. And that plow, if you can imagine it, has been improved upon in materials, but it can never be improved upon in design, because there is one and only one perfect plowshare, and mathematics can discover it for us. This is the point of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment existed to ameliorate the condition of mankind, to make life a little easier for that farmer, so that in his spare time he could read, or read Homer in the original Greek, or participate in a civic council, or help to govern the school to which his children were attending. So if we can ameliorate the condition of mankind with these discoveries that penetrate into the deeper harmonies of the world, we've done an enormous service for humanity. Now, when I came back to this country, I did not patent that plow. Had I patented it, I might not have died helplessly in debt. But I don't really believe in patents, because when I discovered that plow, it wasn't really my invention, it was my capacity to discover, to uncover that design which was waiting to be revealed. Anyone who creates something that can help other people live more happily, with greater satisfaction, with less pain, is uncovering something that might have been uncovered by any number of people. Why would we give him a monopoly that would restrain the diffusion of so interesting a technology or invention? So in 1814, when a man named Charles McPherson wrote to me about this and was questioning my attitude towards patents, I said this, and this is really the heart of the Enlightenment. I said, "He who takes an idea from me informs himself without disinforming me, just as he who lights his torch from my candle illuminates himself without darkening me." You see? He who lights his torch from my candle illuminates himself without darkening me. That's the spirit of the breathtaking age in which I lived. Now, let me tell a different sort of story about America's place in France. When I first arrived there, I was already something of a known quantity because I had published one book in the course of my life. Its title is Notes on the State of Virginia. And there was a theory that was brooded about in my time by Europeans called the degeneracy theory. And they believed that the New World, ours, the Western Hemisphere, had somehow emerged from the last great flood later than Europe. And because of that, our lands were cooler and moister than their counterparts in Europe. And because of that, said these scientists, our animals and plants and indigenous peoples were comparatively degenerate to those of Europe. Now, you know that this is not true. This is a kind of a pseudoscience based upon ignorance, but this was a very widely held view in European circles. And the greatest scientist of the entire era, the Comte de Buffon, who wrote 43 volumes, had repeated and deepened this degeneracy theory. And he had gone farther than some of his colleagues when he said, not only are the American counterparts comparatively less fecund and less majestical, but Europeans who migrate to the New World have the tendency to degenerate there. And so I wrote this book, Notes on Virginia, and it's really a kind of almanac of Greater Virginia, but at the end of it, there are tables showing European animals and their American counterparts, and what I proved was that if anything is true, our flora and fauna are mightier than those of Europe because they have not been tampered with by domestication, haven't been forced out of their natural habitats. But when I arrived in France, this nonsense was still widely circulating. And so my friend, the Marquis de Chasteloup, got me a dinner with this Comte de Buffon. We went over to his salon. He was the royal gardener in Paris. We went to his salon, and after the tablecloth had been removed, Chasteloup said, well, this is Mr. Jefferson, an American diplomat, who in his book Notes on Virginia has refuted your degeneracy theory. The great Buffon, whom I deeply admire, did not even look me in the eye. He merely went up to his shelf in ennui and took off his latest book and said, give this to the American. When he shall have read this, he will see that he is entirely in error. I then spoke out because it had offended me, not that he held these views, but that he was unwilling to listen to evidence. And so I said, sir, in your published books, you have said that the European reindeer is identical to the American moose. This is certainly not so. I said, you have said in your published books that American animals have horns or antlers smaller than those of their European counterparts. I could show you antlers or horns that are 3 feet, 4 feet, even 5 feet in length. He scoffed. And then perhaps I went too far because I said, it is my opinion that your European reindeer could walk under the belly of an American moose. Well, this effectively ended the conversation. But now my pride was engaged. And so I wrote a letter to Mr. Madison, my closest friend, and the one that I leaned on for moments like this. And in that letter I said, send me a moose. Well, Mr. Madison had no moose. But he wrote to John Sullivan, the Revolutionary War governor of New Hampshire, and said, Mr. Jefferson, I find, requires a moose. And so Sullivan went out and got one, and he wrote a lugubrious letter about this and said he'd gone 20 miles into the bush and had to take a number of soldiers, and it was a blizzard, and they had all these problems. They finally found this splendid bull moose and shot it, and then realized that they must now drag that 1,500-pound carcass back to civilization. But they did it, and they eviscerated it, of course, and they removed and cataloged all of its bones, and they took its magnificent peltries and put them in tissue, and then this fabulous fabulous hornage. They put in all of it into a huge crate and shipped it to Thomas Jefferson, minister plenipotentiary, court of Louis XVI, France. Well, I must tell you that this occurred over a long period of time, and by now I had essentially forgotten about this errand. When at my salon on the Champs-Élysées, suddenly there appeared this crate, and Sullivan had sent it COD, and it cost about £20 sterling to redeem it, which was an enormous amount of money. You don't even want to know. And when I opened it, I found that there was this incredible antlerage, but the skin had been somewhat damaged in transit. And so I took it to the French equivalency of a taxidermist and said, rebuild it. And so this happened, and it was a very rickety, sort of awkward-looking thing, but there it was with its skin over its frame and its beautiful horns. And then I sent it by courier over to the Comte de Buffon with the compliments of the American minister. And this is what I call the ocular proof. And so imagine when he opened his door, and there was this extraordinary quadruped that by itself refuted all of the degeneracy theories. He wrote me a polite little note, and he said that he saw now that he had been in error, and that in his future publications he would attempt to correct this heresy. But he never did. And as I think you know, the European notion that Americans are degenerate has not entirely been refuted in your time. My friend.
We move next to the music of Beethoven. We contrast it to Mozart, who is capturing the spirit of the rational Enlightenment, writing music that was perfect in every way. If there is a figure in music who is most associated with the revolutionary age, then that would be Beethoven. He embodied the revolution in many ways. One way was that he simply thought it was appropriate for musicians and composers to use music as a form of expression, not as a way of capturing the Enlightenment, but as a way of expressing personal feeling. And so you will hear Beethoven expressing the passion that governed his life, not only the passion, but the fury. He's also a revolutionary figure because he was interested in these social movements and wanted to give them expression. And he reached out to the players and dedicated his music to them. But he was also a revolutionary figure because, unlike his predecessors, he wanted musicians to be reputable, to have a means of earning income, and to do it as legitimate artisans and freelance composers, and not captive to a mercenary system and to the courts and the piques and the whims of the ruling aristocrats. And so we give you the music of Beethoven. This happens to be the first piece that he ever published, 1790. It's opus number one. And there was a gathering in a salon. In this case, it was Vienna. And it was advertised that the young Beethoven would be offering his first. His reputation had preceded him. His mentors, Haydn, even Mozart, had praised him. And so people flooded into this salon with great curiosity to see what it was about Beethoven. Haydn, his mentor, was in the room. When he offered this, it was too much for their ears. They dismissed it as the impetuous ravings of a deranged young man. Haydn and Beethoven had words afterwards. Haydn tried to explain to him that it was a little much. They parted. They never shared company after that. But even at that young age, 20, here is Beethoven trying to express the revolutionary sentiment of his age. Thank you.
That did seem a little demented. I don't think he's going to last. If music is the music of the spheres, the clock has been overwound, in my opinion. That's too much for me. My serenity has been ruffled. That is extraordinarily exuberant music. You know, there were periods in it where there's a kind of lovely calmness, but then some sort of mania seems to enter in.
And I'll tell you, Mr. President, the convention was to establish a first theme, and that was the revolutionary theme, and then the convention was to establish a second theme, and that was the calmer theme that you heard. And then in the sonata form, they would put the two in contrast, but also in tension. Mm-hmm. And the question is, which one would win out? And as you heard, it was a stalemate. He couldn't decide,
but you can feel the atmosphere of Europe in 1790 in this piece, the sense that the masses are beginning to rise and this energy is irrational and passionate and overwhelming and dangerous, and yet in competition with these ancient patterns of harmony and the social order. And that's exactly what I saw when I came to France. And so I just want to give a very brief discussion of this one letter that I wrote to Madison. Because when you look at France with all of its beauties and all of its degradations, I had to ask myself, could this ever happen to us? Will we reach the point where the distribution of the fruits of life is so out of balance that it literally forces the people to rise up and reclaim their bread and their property and their ancient rights? Is this inevitable in culture? Does every Greece fail? Does every Roman Republic descend into empire? Is it inevitable that you cannot maintain the principles and ideals of a civilization over the long run? And if you don't want a reign of terror where the people spasmodically rise up to overthrow the existing order, is there some way that we can engineer a peaceful form of revolution that doesn't require muskets and bricks and mortar? And so this really began to dwell in my mind about the possibilities of the United States, whether we could maintain a republic in the long run. You remember that when the Founding Fathers met in Philadelphia in 1787, I wasn't among them, I was in Europe at this time, and they had secret deliberations for the summer, May through September of 1787, and thanks to Mr. Madison, who was the great man at the convention, they created a compromise constitution, the one that you still use in your own time. But there was a secrecy order, and they weren't allowed to talk about the proceedings outside of Independence Hall because they were afraid that this would create too many pressures on their deliberations. So I was in the dark along with everyone else, and even my friend Madison wouldn't break that code of secrecy, and so we all watched this process. And when they finally emerged on September 17th, 1787, the great old man of America, the greatest man perhaps, Benjamin Franklin, was asked, "So Dr. Franklin, what have you created?" And he said, in his usual wise way, "A republic, if you can keep it. A republic, if you can keep it." And that's the question. And so I wrote to Madison this series of letters about distribution of wealth and national debts and so on, and in one of them I said, the only way to prevent armed rebellion is to have peaceful revolutions instead. We're fortunate in that we have our new constitution where the president only serves for 4 years. That automatically gives the people the right to change their mind about their leadership every fourth year. You know, in France, when the French people wanted to remove Louis XVI from the throne, they had to begin by cutting off of his head. So we have this peaceful mechanism that enables us to do the same thing. And when Adams my predecessor, was discredited at the polls in 1800, he quietly packed his bags and went back to Massachusetts. Margaret Bayard Smith, my good friend from Washington, D.C., who witnessed my inaugural, said, "This is a unique moment in human history because these moments where power is shifted from one party of men to a different one are usually attended by riots and shootings and mass deaths." But she said, "In this our happy republic today, I have seen a peaceful transfer of power without a single fist being raised." So we created this system whereby we have mechanism, tools of liberty that no other people had ever had before. And of course, if we really get upset, we can impeach federal officers. Now, I do believe that the Founding Fathers made a mistake when they narrowly construed impeachment as only for high crimes and misdemeanors. I think they should have made a broader sweep and said, gross incompetence, senility, betrayal of the fundamental principles of our republic. There should have been some tool outside of high crimes and misdemeanors to enable us to have a vote of no confidence from time to time. But even so, we have the House of Representatives that could be completely transformed every second year, the Senate every sixth year, the President every fourth year, and impeachment if we need it. And the Constitution contains a clause in which the states can call for a new constitutional convention. We also can amend the Constitution as long as we can produce a very decided majority of the American people. But for all of that, I still felt that we hadn't gone far enough in keeping people engaged in their own form of self-government. And so I said to Mr. Madison, this is probably the most radical letter that I ever wrote, and I said, "If it is true that the earth belongs to the living and not the dead, then the dead have no rights. The previous generation should be seen as almost a foreign country." And we came together in 1776 and again in 1787 and formed constitutions that we demanded that the people ratify. And so the people consented to their form of government. What then of our children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren? Do they have the capacity to consent to the form of government of their choice? No, you know. You have never in your lives been asked to consent to your system of government. It has been presumed that you will accept it. This is known as tacit consent. But I don't believe that that's legitimate. And so I said to Madison, if we can agree on the principle that the earth belongs to the living and not the dead, then we should, on principle, tear up the Constitution of the United States once every generation. I used actuarial tables to determine that that's about 19 years. Or put it this way, and I don't mean to spread alarm, but if you take this group of, say, 500 people, within 100 years, you will all be dead. Within 70 years, some percentage of you will be dead. Within 2 years, some small group will be gone. But if there are 500 people in this room, when 251 are no longer alive, your consent dissolves at that moment, according to the principles of majority rule. So I worked from actuarial tables and worked out a generation at about 19 years and said to Madison, therefore, I propose that we tear up the Constitution once every 19 years and begin fresh. Mr. Madison was not persuaded. He wrote back a letter in which he said, this is the way he would write to me. You know, if you've ever seen that famous painting by Raphael where Plato is pointing up to the heavens and Aristotle is reminding him of the earth, I was the Plato of this arrangement and Madison was the Aristotle, and I would write him these letters, these whimsical letters about the nature of civilization and fundamental laws, and then he would work with exquisite enlightenment subtlety and charm to talk me out of it. He would say something like, this is the greatest idea that I have ever read without a single exception in the entire course of my life. It's it gets at the heart of what's at stake in civilization, and no philosopher has ever been able to point out this principle as well as you have, Mr. Jefferson. And he would say, but let me suggest a few thoughts, since we don't live in an ideal world, we live in the one in which we find ourselves. Here are just a couple of quick thoughts about your ingenious letter, and then there would be an 18-point refutation of what I had said with a much deeper intellectual penetration than I was ever able to bring to it. But then at the end of this, when he had demolished my favorite idea, he would say, but let me say again that this is the greatest idea I have ever read, and I hope that civilization will evolve until at some future point genius of this sort will have its audience. And so that's the sort of letter he wrote about this. But I think I was right that consent matters. And let me just say this, and then I'll ask you to perform one more piece. If you don't find mechanisms for renewal of your civilization, you will corrupt it to the point of a French Revolution. If you study history, there is no example of a nation that didn't find mechanisms of national renewal, that didn't slip into runaway spending and overregulation and overtaxation and corruption and indifference by government to the needs and the rights of man. The dynamics of history cannot be avoided just because we're America. We have advantages that no people has ever had in history. This great fertile Mississippi Valley, the size of the nation, the Atlantic Ocean, which separates us by 3,000 miles from the madness of Europe. But the fact is that we are not immune to the corruption of culture. And so you either have to find a peaceful mechanism of national renewal, or greatly increase your public education, or you inevitably will slip into a sort of dotage and corruption and centralization and fiscal irresponsibility and paralysis in government, which will make you impotent as a people. And so my suggestion to you is a simple one. May your revolutions be as peaceful as possible and as bloody as necessary. Sir?
Mr. President, let us attempt to restore you to your former serenity.
You stirred me up with this Beethoven. Now that's music. That was perfection. What did we just hear?
The music of Haydn.
Oh my, that is exactly what music should be. You can feel Monticello. You can feel the pastoral. You can feel serenity and rationality and civilization in that piece. That's precisely why we have music. I'm much calmer now. No more Beethoven. I knew Mozart's work. I saw it performed in France in my time, and Beethoven was just beginning to make his move. I was barely aware of his work, but it was not something that I would have heard in my time in France. I think we should take a few questions. So who has one? And if you come up to the microphones, we'll do it, but I'll start with you, sir. Just go ahead and I'll repeat it. And you can ask questions of Russell Hancock, too, if you please. I'd happily yield. Go ahead, sir.
You spoke of liberty, and you spoke of many things. In particular, I'm curious, Mr. President, at the time that you were a part of the emergence of the New Republic, what kind of conversations were taking place with the world bankers in their interests to have their hand in the funds of the United States? And I'm curious, given the approximately 100 years now of the loss of the United States and its ability to actually create its own funds, what you would hope might be possible for us.
Thank you. Yes. Well, let me say, first of all, that I'll try to give rapid answers to these questions so we can get a few of them in. But my biggest concern when I became the President of the United States in 1801 was our national debt, because I believe that a national debt is a national disgrace. It's a way of taxing our children and our grandchildren without their consent. And so I wanted to get us into fiscal responsibility in a very big way. We were deeply in debt to Dutch bankers at this time. And if you owe money to another nation, that puts that nation in a very powerful position with respect to your own destiny. And so I wanted us to clear that as quickly as possible. Mr. Hamilton was the father of the national debt. He believed, he had studied European banking theory, and he believed that a national debt properly managed is a national asset. I don't agree with that. I think we should have a balanced budget requirement in our Constitution so that we are not enabled to borrow against future generations. But that was not a part of the Constitution, as you know. That I had hoped that that would be one of the Bill of Rights. It did not turn out to be the case. And so when I became president, I inherited his debt, which was $80 million. That's about 8 times the national budget of the United States. So this was a very large national debt. And I made it my principle to reduce that debt as severely as possible during my 2 terms, and we did. I think there's probably no president in your history who has a greater record of public fiscal responsibility. We reduced the national debt between 1801 and 1809 by $37 million, and we did it, and this will astonish you, we had a $10 million annual budget. None of this came from internal taxes. The only funds we had at the Treasury of the United States came from import duties on luxury items at port or land sales in the American West, and that gave us a budget of $10 million per year. And of that $10 million, for 8 years in a row, I dedicated $7.3 million to debt retirement. Think of this. 73% of the budget of the United States went to debt retirement. We lived on the remaining pittance. There were things I would have liked to have done, a national university, a national museum to house the Lewis and Clark treasuries and so on. But until we reached total fiscal responsibility and owed no foreigner a dime, I would not rest. And of course, then Madison went on to retire much more of the national debt, and so we got it taken care of within my lifetime. So that's my answer in my own time to this question. Sir.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead here.
Thank you, Mr. President. And if you can channel, this is a question for you, and if you can channel Theodore Roosevelt, I would appreciate his opinion on the same topic. What is your opinion on presidents using executive orders when they think that Congress is not responding to, does not desire, or is not responding to their, what they think the country needs?
Right. Look, executive orders do not exist in the Constitution of the United States. If you read your Constitution, there is no mention of any sort of executive orders. Now, President Washington had a few, I had a few. Most presidents use them, but until very recently, until the late 20th century, these executive orders were almost entirely procedural. In other words, they had to do with the mechanisms of government, but not with policy. And that's how it should be. You know, we have a republic, and the theory of the republic is very simple, that there are three branches of the national government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, and the branch that actually represents the sovereign, you, is the legislative. And so you have sent these agents to your state capital and to the national capital to do your bidding. You have not granted them unlimited power. You have asked them to do certain things to represent your will because we don't have a pure democracy in which all of you would participate. They're your agents. Of the two branches of the Congress, the House of Representatives is closer to the people than the Senate because it's elected every second year, and therefore the Constitution makers wisely said that two things can only originate in the House, war and taxation. All money bills must start in the House of Representatives because that's the branch that most closely protects your own pockets. And so if in your time or any time the executive has begun to legislate from the White House, doing things that properly belong to the representatives of the people, you must check those executives by way of impeachment if necessary. And Roosevelt will not be making an appearance.
Thomas Paine avoided the guillotine during the Terror only by clerical error. You admired the Terror. Did you admire Paine?
Did I admire Thomas Paine? Yes. You know, that's a very interesting story about Paine. So he came from England to the United States, and he had only been here a very short time when he wrote Common Sense. And Common Sense was published in January of 1776. It was a runaway bestseller. I think it sold 150,000 copies within a few months. And these were copies that were made on these very clumsy hand presses of this period. So to produce that many copies of a 50-page pamphlet is an unbelievable record of production. And George Washington had Common Sense read to his troops. And this really galvanized the American spirit of independence more than anything else, because Paine had a genius for taking complex ideas and putting them into plain English, Common Sense. And so this book was extraordinarily important to our national cause. Then Paine went to France about the same time that I did, and he became a sort of honorary citizen of the French Republic once the king had been beheaded and the old system overthrown. But he was always more moderate than the fieriest members of the Terror, and eventually he was tried and convicted, and he was slated for execution. So he's in a horrible fetid prison in Paris, and what they did was every day they would come in, and the people who had been put on Robespierre's lists would have a piece of a chalk X put on the doorway of their prison cell. And so then the executioners would come through later in the day, and wherever there was an X, they would take those people out, and they would suffer capital punishment with the guillotine. Paine was very ill at this time, and he was always beloved by the people around him, including his jailers. And so on the day in question, the Terror had actually slated him for execution, and the mark had been put on his door, but because he was so ill, the jailer had opened the door to allow fresh air to get to Paine's bed, and because of that, the X was behind the door. He came this close to execution. And because the X was hidden by the open door, they passed on, and soon Robespierre fell. When Paine was finally released, having come that close to death, I, who loved him and admired his work, offered to send an American ship over to France to bring him back to the United States. It turns out he came under private conveyance, but I then kept him in the White House for about a month with me, and nothing that I did in the whole course of my presidency was more controversial than that, because Payne had damaged his reputation with the American people in his two-volume work, The Age of Reason. Common sense, beloved, but The Age of Reason was a relatively sarcastic and nasty attack on received Christianity. And the American people were appalled that he would go out of his way to offend on a religious question. His views of religion were essentially identical to my own, but I would never try to offend anyone with these things. Never speak publicly, certainly never publish a book. And because he had published this sort of sneering refutation of the miracles and the apocalyptic matter of the New Testament, the American people turned on him. And while he was in jail, in the period leading up to his execution, he had written an open letter to President Washington criticizing Washington. And if there's one thing that you could never safely do, it was publicly criticize George Washington. And so the American people were no longer his friend, and they were angry at me for letting Payne stay with me. But I would do it again in a moment, because he was a man who helped to bring about revolution, not only in our country, but also in France. Go ahead.
Welcome, Mr. President. It's a great honor to have you in the Far West. You spoke of the contradiction between the brilliance of the French civilization and the degradation of its people. And yet, in your own Virginia, you have a significant segment of the population, namely African slaves, whose living conditions, if anything, are worse than the French peasants. So I have two questions for you, sir. One is philosophical, and the other is practical. By what rationale would you not apply the principles of the Enlightenment to slaves in your own community? And the second one is a practical one. Regardless of your reasons for not applying those principles, weren't you concerned, sir, about a bloody revolution or a reign of terror as a result of the same suppression that you said was the cause of the French Revolution?
Right. Well, that's a well-stated question. Let me give as brief an answer as I can to this. First of all, I agree with you that if you write all men are created equal, it applies to everybody, all men, women, adults and children, Jews and Gentiles and Catholics and Methodists, Indians of the West, Mohammedans, that this is a universal principle, and it is not dependent upon one's race or one's gender or one's economic status. And so I do believe in my core that all human beings are entitled to identical treatment in the machine of the law, and that their natural rights are universal. Now the question is, how do you apply this in a culture that has already enslaved African Americans? How do you get out from under this? And really, this was one of the hardest questions of my life, and I tried as well as I could to figure out how we were going to do it. There are several problems. One is, of course, we were utterly economically dependent upon this class of laborers. Secondly, we had grave doubts about the equality of the races, and so if we made freedmen of Negroes, then my question was, can we produce a biracial republic? Leaving out racial characteristics altogether, these are people who come from very savage tribal conditions in Africa, who were kidnapped and brought across the Atlantic Ocean to the New World, sold to the highest bidder, suppressed with the ravages and appalling mistreatment of slavery, kept childlike in their dependency upon their masters and overseers. And so you can't just one day open all of the doors of all of the slave quarters and say, be free. This is going to be a very complex business of trying to bring them to a state of self-sufficiency. I was mostly reluctant to free my own slaves because I'm a paternalist, because I felt that, and I know this will sound perverse to you, and perhaps it is, but I felt in some limited respect they were better off at Monticello, where they were protected by benevolence, than to be loosed into a world where they had no rights that any human being was bound to respect, no prospects of employment. You know, in 1808, Virginia passed a law requiring every freed slave to leave within 12 months and never return. So later in life, I said, this is like having the wolf by the ears. You can't hang on, and you can't let go. It's an impossible dilemma. And so we wrestled with this, and I could go into great detail about the mechanisms I tried to create to free all of our Negro brethren, either gradually or immediately, but I always believed, and you will probably find this unacceptable, but I believe that once they were freed, we must find them a homeland, either in Cuba or Haiti or the western parts of the continent, out in Texas or someplace, or that we must repatriate them in their native Africa. But I could not, as a social philosopher, envision a time when there would be sufficient harmony between these two races to live within a single constitutional republic. And as to your question about slave rebellion, we were paranoid about this. There were a number of small slave rebellions in the course of my lifetime, including Gabriel's, just at the time that I became the third president. And then when Toussaint Louverture revolutionized Haiti, Santo Domingo, all slaveholders feared that this would spread to North America and it would lead to a Spartacus-like war, which would either end in the extermination of one or the other races. And so we were aware of our hypocrisy. We knew that this was an unsupportable, unsustainable, illegal, appalling practice. We fretted about it. We fretted about it out of a sense of personal safety. We fretted about it because it made us such hypocrites. You know, Samuel Johnson, the British moralist, said in 1776, "Isn't it interesting that those who yelp loudest for liberty are also the drivers of Negro slaves?" And he meant Washington and Monroe and Madison and myself and Patrick Henry. 8 of the first 12 presidents were slaveholders. And so I plead guilty to your charge, and all I can say is that, first, we were not unaware of this hypocrisy, and it troubled us. And secondly, if I could have found a way to do it and still believe that this republic could survive, I would have wanted to do it. But in practical terms, it's an exceedingly complex and difficult business. And I've tried in this answer not to say a single defensive thing, although I feel a great sense of defensiveness, because I knew without any question that slavery would cast a shadow over my life's work, and that it in some sense revealed me as a contemptible man. I'm going to take two quick more questions, and then we're going to have some more music.
Okay. Mr. President, sir, earlier you alluded to a second American Revolution in 1800.
Yes.
I never learned about that in school. Can you tell us more about it, please?
The second American Revolution, well, you may be a Federalist, of course, and in which case you would not agree with this, but the founding fathers who met in Philadelphia created our Constitution, and then they peopled the government for the first 12 years. So these are people like George Washington and John Adams and Timothy Pickering and Rufus King and so on, but particularly Colonel Alexander Hamilton. And they were brilliant men, war heroes, extraordinary statesmen, but they did not believe that the American people were capable of self-government. And I just remind you of Hamilton's famous speech to the Constitutional Convention in June of 1787. I wasn't there, but Madison took down the speech verbatim. It was a five-hour speech in which Hamilton outlined his ideal system of government. And let me just quickly give you the highlights. President to serve for life. Senators to serve for life. Governors to be appointed by the national executive. The president to have an unqualified veto over acts of the Congress. The national government to have an unqualified veto over legislation of the states. Hamilton said of you, the people who are gathered here today, the people, they are a beast. They're a rabble entirely incapable of reflection and self-restraint. He said they must be governed by the wise, the rich, and the well-born, meaning, of course, himself and his cronies. That's where this country was heading. You know, George Washington, for all of his greatness, refused to shake hands with the American people. when he would have these levees once a week, the people could come up and he would bow stiffly to them. But you were never allowed to touch him. And there's a famous incident between Hamilton and Gouverneur Morris. They were his two closest friends. And Hamilton said, "Well, I can touch him. Watch, I'll go clap him on the back." And Gouverneur Morris said, "If you do that, I will buy you the best dinner that Philadelphia can support." So Hamilton, with his usual arrogance, walked up to the great man, and he was just about to touch him on the back when he thought better of it. And so he then just barely put his fingers on General Washington's shoulder. And the great man turned and gave Hamilton a look of fiery disdain, and with his hand took Hamilton's off of his shoulder and walked out of the room. These two first presidents, Washington and Adams, were behaving like crypto monarchs. Adams was worse. Adams, who never was in a battle in his life, insisted on wearing a ceremonial sword as president. He would trip over it, it would be caught between his legs. He had no idea how to maneuver a sword at his side. It was a total absurdity that this man of peace was carrying a ceremonial sword because he believed somehow that involved the majesty of the presidency. And he was the first officer of the Senate. You know, the vice president is the presiding officer of the Senate. Adams, who was my very dear friend, wasted 2 weeks of congressional time by insisting on titles of nobility for our national officers. He said, "They'll never receive the respect they deserve unless we give them titles." And so I think his title for George Washington was His Excellency and the Preserver of American Liberties. Finally, Mr. Madison, who was a member of the first Congress of the United States, said, "There is a title for this being. He's to be called the President of the United States." And that put an end to it. But because Adams was so hot for titles, some of the wits of Congress gave him one, and for the rest of his life he was known as His Rotundity. So these great men did not share our optimism about the people's capacity to govern themselves, and they had to be retired to private life before they destroyed the revolution. Otherwise, armed conflict. And so Mr. Madison came to me, and he's really the father of the Republican Party. It's not the same Republican Party that you have. It was the early small r Republican Party, later morphed into the Republican Democratic Party. That's why you have Jefferson Jackson dinners. But this first iteration of it was known as the Republican Party, and Madison was its creator. And he came to me and he said, "Mr. Jefferson, you must stand for the presidency." I did not want to do this. I have no ambition to govern men. I love my private life at Monticello. I want to listen to music. I want to garden. I want to read books. I want to study Homer. I want to engage in scientific experiments. I want to ride my horses. I want serenity and peace and happiness and family. But Madison knew that the only person of our political stamp who could displace these Federalists was me, because Madison, and I mean no disrespect, but he was a little shrimp of a man, and he was a hypochondriac, and he pretended that he had epileptic fits, and he wore black, and he was dour and grim, and so he didn't have an ounce of charisma. And so he came to me and he pushed me to stand for the presidency, and I finally said, "I will agree to stand for this office on one condition, that I need make no public appearances of any sort." And I didn't. I just stayed at Monticello and listened to this sort of music, and the people voted and, of course, narrowly preferred me to John Adams. And John Adams was retired after a single term, and in some sense he never got over it. So I don't think that it's wrong to call this the Second American Revolution. Then I walked to my inaugural. I refused to wear fancy clothing. I dressed in sort of a genteel, shabby chic. I opened the door at the White House to visitors, sometimes in my house slippers. There was a famous incident where the wife of the British ambassador, Mrs. Anthony Mary, came to supper, and when the dinner bell was sounded, she assumed as a widower that I would take her arm as the wife of the most senior diplomat in Washington, but I didn't. I wanted to teach these British diplomats a lesson in in Republican culture. So I went with Mrs. Madison into table, and poor Mrs. Mary had to go with a mere congressman into supper. And her husband was jostled about, and he had to find such table situation as he could. And after the dinner, they came up to me, and they were just livid with anger and wrath and frustration. They felt that they were amongst barbarians. Barbarians who make music like this. And Mrs. Mary said, shaking, "I demand to know what is the protocol of this administration." To which I replied, "Why, madam, it is pell-mell." Hold those. Stay close. We're going to hear one more superb piece.
We will play a final piece.
And then we will break character and briefly entertain your thoughts. St. Michael Trio, Vicky Wang on cello. Daniel Scher on violin. And my friend from the Bay Area, Russell Hancock, on piano. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you.
Oh. Well, first, we're just about done, I promise you, but Russell, tell us a little bit about two things. What did we just hear, and tell us about the origins of this concert.
We just heard the music of Franz Joseph Haydn, who was the mentor to Mozart and then also had an influence upon Beethoven, and that was the finale of the last trio that he wrote. It's considered his greatest trio, the great C major trio. Now, you're asking the origins of, you have to help me here.
Well, how we got started working together.
Thank you. Well, it's the most wonderful thing. We three in the St. Michael Trio aspire to be like Mr. Jefferson. We want to be Jeffersonian, by which we mean we want to pursue a life of many facets. And so we all three actually have day jobs. I'm the president and CEO of an organization called Joint Venture Silicon Valley, and I also teach at Stanford in the public policy program. Danny is a medical doctor, and he works in the medical device industry. And Vicky, among her other talents, is also a dental hygienist and works with her husband who is a dentist. And she's also highly trained on the concert stage. Well, anyway, and in my role as the president of this Silicon Valley organization that tackles large regional planning issues, we had come to the crux of a decision. The Bay Area, unlike Seattle Puget Sound region, is fraught with dysfunction. We are unable to make basic planning decisions about housing and land use and transportation, and it seemed to us that we needed to consider making an overarching framework for decision-making in the Bay Area so that we could tackle some of these vexing problems. And so we convened a gathering of our entire region. We called it the State of Silicon Valley Conference, and it occurred to me that to get us in the frame of mind for making revolutionary decisions about governance, that we needed to bring in a person who had distance on the problem. And so we reached out to Thomas Jefferson.
And so, I mean, imagine of all the places that Thomas Jefferson could go, Silicon Valley, which just epitomizes everything that he loved. I mean, if Jefferson were alive today, imagine what he would have by way of gadgets. He kept 5 daily diaries. He was a human record-keeping machine. He had a polygraph, a pantograph to make copies of all of his letters. Just imagine Jefferson with a GPS unit or with a pad or, you know, I'm going to Rome in a few days, and I'm going to spend 3 weeks there. And so I'm taking about 20 books as books, enormous weight. But I also, in my iPad, have about 30 books. And yesterday I found a passage that I'm reading a biography of Jefferson on this device, and I found a passage I like. So I was able to send it to myself from my iPad back into my iPad, so that I can then put it in a Word file. I mean, we're living in, as you know, we're living in Jefferson's moment in terms of communication, access. I'm going to be taking students to see the Last Judgment in the Sistine Chapel. And if you've ever seen the Last Judgment, it's almost impossible to come to terms with because it's so massive and so dark and so crowded in there. And you have this very, very busy Counter-Reformation masterwork of Michelangelo, and so you just sort of jostle through, but thanks to high-resolution images of the Last Judgment, the day before, I can show them things that I want them to look at. It's absolutely astonishing today that there can be a single bad teacher anywhere, given the tools that we now have. Remember, when I was going to college, when you take an art history class, you literally would go to the bookstore and you'd get a little gray envelope that had 7 or 8 postcard-like great masters. Well, there's the Mona Lisa, there's Guernica, and they were just cheesy, badly printed. Today, if you go home and just say Caravaggio, you could spend the rest of the year looking at Caravaggio paintings in enormous detail with great commentary. If Jefferson were alive now, he would say, If you can't recover your democracy with these tools, you don't want it at all. Because we now can watch everything. We can watch every piece of legislation as it's unfolding. We can write our congresspeople at midnight or 4 a.m. We have access that no people have ever had to the machinery of government. And we have more information at our disposal than any people who ever lived have. And so you would hope that this would lead to a new Jeffersonian movement. It doesn't seem to be doing it. It feels a lot like Kardashians to me, you know. And so, but this sort of concert, and we've not done this before here, but when I was just sitting here listening to this music, I thought, well, no wonder it was the age of reason. Listen to how they entertained themselves. Just absolute magnificence. And in Jefferson's time, all music was live. And so Jefferson actually wrote a letter to an Italian friend and said, well, I can't afford a band. The limits of an American fortune don't allow that. But what if you could find me 4 or 5 musicians in Italy who could be gardeners by day and play the clarinet and oboe at night? And, you know, we'll multitask. Well, it never worked out, but just imagine what it was like to live in a time when this was routine musical entertainment, at least amongst the people who had some significant means. Jefferson himself was a violinist, although he would not regard himself as of your capacity. So we're out of time. Let's quickly, what was on your mind? What was Jefferson's greatest academic passion? Greek, ancient Greek. If you want to be Jeffersonian, you have to learn ancient Greek. I did ancient Greek at University of Minnesota and Oxford, and I can struggle with it. My daughter is now a junior at Columbia in New York, and she called the other day and she said, Dad, I'm going to be a classics major. And I said, well, this is, and I meant this, I said, this is wonderful. Now you are technically unemployable. You know, and I mean this in the best possible way, because I keep saying to her, you're getting one of the last great liberal arts educations that the world has. You're going to Columbia, and by the way, I'll be selling Amway products afterwards. Have you sent your children to college? Wow, you know. So, it's really been a rough couple of years. She's a junior. So, when she started at Columbia, I started eating ramen. But now I'm eating generic ramen. You know? You know, when you go to generic ramen, you know that they're gouging you. And so there she is, and she's now a classics major, you know. I mean, there's absolutely no shred of utilitarianism in this. All she can do is teach others to waste their lives. You know? It's fabulous. I couldn't be prouder of if I tried. No, absolutely. But it has been somewhat rough economically, I can tell you that. So Jefferson believed that the ideal American knew some Greek, and that you could grow a tomato, that you sort of you had some inventiveness in your daily life. And so for him, when his second library was sold to Congress in 1815, it became the basis of our Library of Congress, then he woke up and realized the contract was he had to sell absolutely every book. And he then said, I cannot live without books. So then he amassed a third library of about 3,000 volumes at a time when a book cost about $250 or $300 in our currency. And mostly he had mathematics and Greek at that point. And just a few weeks before his death in 1826, Jefferson was reading Thucydides, one of the hardest of all the Greek historians, without a dictionary and without a grammar. And he regarded that as human happiness. And when my daughter is going to, she'll never be that good. Nobody can be that good, but, you know, she's learning Greek and bankrupting her father at the same time. And it's just, for Jefferson, that somehow that's what it meant, to have your hands in the soil. Quickly, yes.
Without throwing away the Constitution every 19 years, but maybe adapting and evolving, how would the original authors have maybe spoken to those that want to take it actual letter by letter with regard to, I don't know, gun control?
Yeah, the in our time, the super literalists who are saying, you know, that
You hear it all the time. Judges are legislating from the bench, and the founding fathers this and the founding fathers that. I'm pretty contemptuous of that sort of argument because the founding fathers had the three-fifths clause. The founding fathers had the fugitive slave clause. The founding fathers didn't believe that women were fully developed souls. Are we sure we want to take the founding fathers as the only source of wisdom on life on earth? Not I. I mean, they were extraordinary people, but they were blind in some really fundamental respects. And so whenever people say, well, the founding fathers intended this, I think a couple of things. First, the founding fathers had a huge spectrum, with Thomas Paine on the left and Hamilton on the right and everybody else in between, but they couldn't agree on much. And the Constitutional Convention nearly fell apart because of these fundamental divides of big state, small state, slavery, non-slavery, and so on. And so you can't create a phalanx of the founding fathers. And the notion that sort of, in some quarters in our time, that we should go back to the world of the founding fathers strikes me as insane. They could not have anticipated the NSA, right? I mean, ask Madison, will the time come when Google will hand over its trunk to the National Security Agency so that if you say in a telephone call this afternoon, Taliban, that will trip a wire somewhere? The founding fathers couldn't have anticipated our world. They couldn't have understood electric lighting. It was a 3-mile-per-hour world. What would they say about cloning, about stem cells, about cyber pornography, about stalking, about internet sex trafficking, about new kinds of digital currencies springing up in the world? They couldn't have seen any of this, and so for us to think that the founders have the wisdom on these things is absurd. So if you don't tear up the Constitution, as Jefferson suggested, and revise it, then you force jurists to have enormous power, because these jurists who are sitting in St. Louis or in San Francisco have to take something like a struggle between Google and Netflix and try to figure out how in the Constitution written in the age of Newton they're going to sort this out with the Fourth Amendment or the Ninth or the Sixth or the Commerce Clause. And to do that, they have to stretch it. And so we're forcing them to be judicial activists because we won't give them the clues that they need to make decisions according to what we take to be the will of the people. So we need to grow up and stop invoking the founding fathers and start talking about what would life look like in the 21st century if we ever got our act together. Go ahead.
This is for Russell Hancock and the barbarians who make this kind of music.
Yes.
Yeah, Beethoven tore up the dedication to the Eroica.
Yes, he did.
Thomas Jefferson treated Napoleon as a business partner to purchase the Louisiana Purchase. I'm sure Mr. Jefferson, who apparently is no longer on stage, might see it a little differently. Which do you see as being the greater friend of the Enlightenment?
Beethoven or Napoleon?
Beethoven or Jefferson?
Oh, uh-huh. Go ahead.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I would have to say Jefferson, absolutely. How could I not?
Well, Beethoven really belongs to the Romantic movement more
than
what
I want to say. I would not associate him so much with the Enlightenment. I would associate him with other things, expressivism, revolutionary fervor, certainly. But Jefferson was so much more than that.
Well, the story of the dedication to Eroica was directly in response to Napoleon's having usurped democracy in France.
Quite right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So let me close, because I know it's time, by saying this. First of all, another round of applause for the St. Michael Trio. Second of all, there will be a book signing here for those who wish it. And if you're interested in these cultural tours you hear about on the Jefferson Hour, the Wendover Death March in Montana and the Jefferson in France and Jefferson in Virginia, my friend Becky Colley is here, and she can tell you about these trips. We have a literary retreat coming up on January 11th at this fabulous lodge just inside Idaho, west of Missoula. And we spend 4 days looking at books like Walden or Neihardt's Black Elk speaks, and it's just an enchanting way to recover after the mania of Christmas. And so if you're interested in that, and then just finally let me say the thing that I mean most, which is, first of all, Chris Higashi of the Seattle Public Library has been my friend now for 20 years, and we've done this work together, and she's the one who makes all this possible, so I so deeply appreciate her and the foundation and the Seattle Public Library. So thank you very much, Chris. And then finally, let me say that I get to travel. I was just in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and I was just in Washington, D.C., and I've recently been in Telluride, Colorado, and I have the opportunity in the work that I do to travel all over. But it really is the case that of all the places that I ever get to go, the place that I love to go most is Seattle. And let me just say why. You're the readingest people in the United States. There's a kind of a magic in this room whenever we're here. I love what Seattle represents, and if it were closer to North Dakota, and if it rained about 20 inches per year, I would want to live in such a place. But every year, what I look forward to most is the time when I'm standing in the town hall in front of 600 people and talking about ideas in a way that makes people laugh and makes people think again about American possibilities. So if we have entertained you and informed you and enlightened you, we are thrilled. We'll be here. You can talk to us now, but we will close at this point. I'll be over there signing books. People will be over here selling books. Linger as long as you want, and we'll see you next year.
Thanks for tuning in to this visit with President Thomas Jefferson, made possible by author and scholar Clay Jenkinson. Jenkinson is the host of the syndicated radio program The Thomas Jefferson Hour. A co-founder of the modern Chautauqua movement, Jenkinson has also portrayed Sir Francis Bacon, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Theodore Roosevelt, and Meriwether Lewis. He appears in Seattle annually as a longtime friend of the Seattle Public Library. Clay Jenkinson inhabited the role of President Thomas Jefferson at Town Hall Seattle on November 22, 2014. He was joined by the St. Michael Trio for a performance of chamber music popular during Jefferson's lifetime, including works by Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven, who were Jefferson's contemporaries. This event was presented by the Seattle Public Library as part of its 2014 McClellan O'Donnell Living History Series. Thanks to Town Hall Seattle for this recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.